Hello, and thank you very much for listening to this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
Of a photograph from Mule Creek Canyon on the lower Rogue River in southern Oregon. This image was photographed back in 2012, I think at the end of September, beginning of October, while we were on a trip. And we had made it down to southern Oregon where the Rogue River is, and we drove in about 20 miles into the wild and scenic section of the Rogue River and brought our tent down and camped out and backpacked for just a couple days here at the Mule Creek Canyon and then at another spot near Blossom Bar. But this spot was really cool. We stayed here for a couple days, and it was at the beginning of the fishing season after the whitewater rafting trips sort of start to slow down a bit. And down here at the lower Rogue section, the wild and scenic section, it's more limited. There's a rate limit of the amount of rafters or people on boats that can go through the wild and scenic section each day, I think to keep it pristine and natural. But it was a really awesome spot. The photograph was shot on film, and it just really makes me think about how much finding the right type of light and the right environment for it to photograph really makes it come together better. So this is a fun image to put together on the lower Rogue River. I'm sure there's probably a lot of other photographs that I'm going to try and find from lower Rogue too.
You can see more of my work at BillyNewmanPhoto.com. You can check out some of my photo books on Amazon. I think you can look up Billy Newman under the authors section there and see some of the photo books on film, on the desert, on surrealism, on camping. Some cool stuff over there.
This last week, I made a trip out to Central Oregon, and it was still really nice. You know, we had a little bit of rain, I think, out there last Thursday, Friday, and then Saturday, Sunday, it just brightened up a ton. It was super crisp out, super bright, really cold though. I think my friend Dave had just gone out to Eastern Oregon, I think out towards Smith Rock, and he said it was super cold out there too. But yeah, this trip, we did like an overnight trip out there, and I think today I just posted a photograph of something I thought was really cool. It's one of the archaeological remains that are out in Eastern Oregon, and there's a whole interesting history about stuff in Eastern Oregon. But the photo that I posted to Instagram and to Facebook and all the other places today is a photograph of this rock teepee ring that's still in very good condition. It's out in Eastern Oregon in this area, in between, sort of near like where a dry lake bed, where once just a lake would have been. Now what we see in our modern time is just a dry lake bed. But the cool thing is as we kind of look around, you can see the remnants of an old Indian camp that was really quite established in that area. I think it's just amazing to get to go see. And you'll find other artifacts from Indian populations out in Eastern Oregon once you start looking around. Like, you'll start noticing obsidian chips that are on the ground, or you'll start noticing really in like some places, through a lot of Oregon, through a lot of the less developed, less forested areas of Eastern Oregon, there's a lot less erosion that's taken place, natural erosion that's taken place over the last few hundred years. Like over here on the west side of the coast, with all the deciduous plant matter that comes up, there's a lot of turnover that seems to happen. Like a lot of the vegetation is going to end up hiding or overgrowing some of the older encampments or establishments that were made. I mean, right now I'm in the Camas Valley. I'm in the Willamette Valley, where the Kalapuya Indians, where I'm sure out here in front of me in this big field out toward the Willamette River, there's tons of Indian artifacts, tons of old Indian camps, but none of that's really visible because of all the deciduous organic material that's been developed over here over the many hundreds of years since it's been that there was an Indian population in the area. Now, what's interesting about Eastern Oregon is that because it's way more remote, there's very few people out there. There's very few people to disturb a lot of things. And really, sagebrush doesn't grow very fast. Things don't really move around very fast out there. I was there, I think, maybe more than a decade ago, and it was really almost the same as it is now. Very little has changed out there. You know, there's no new houses, no new development, maybe a fence around the thing. That might be it. But it was really cool. So you get out to this area, you hike out to a spot, and you can really see all over the ground. It's just a ton of black obsidian chunks, these unworked pieces of black obsidian that were carried in by people and then dropped there at some point. And all these pieces were used, I think, in the camp to chip out arrowheads and to chip out other tools that they would use. But it's really cool. This teepee ring is really the only Well, there's a few teepee rings, like a few smattering of like of piles of rocks. This teepee ring was really the one that was the most established still. It was most upright still. And you wonder, like, how far back do these go? Like, how far back do these stones that were laid into the ground go? But they would use it sort of like as a foundation for the tent or the hut of the teepee that they would have established there. And then they would, you know, work out of it. And they worked out of it on a bluff, and then they would look out over the hill to the lake area. And yeah, I don't know. They just had a whole system out there. But it's really amazing when you really start to come in and sort of understand the layout of the land and where people would sort of go. And it's very interesting. Man, surreal, really, to get out and like be in a spot like that or sit in the center of the teepee ring where you know there's people, other men, thousands of years ago that were doing work and trying to survive out in really what is now a very harsh environment. And back then was still probably quite harsh, at least in the hundreds of years ago. But man, if you start going back thousands of years, even a few hundred years ago, I guess 500 years ago, a lot of those dry lake areas out in eastern Oregon really still had at least a marsh or at least a wetland or something like that. I mean, like similar to Summer Lake now, you know, parts of the year it's dry, parts of the year it's filled with water. So it might be quite a bit more like that now, but I think in the past it was really... It was just accepted that there was going to be some amount of water in the lake bed all year round instead of it being, you know, a dry lake bed. And I think it's supported by the watershed of a few creeks that are in the area. And out in that area of eastern Oregon, I don't think there's really that many drainages that really go all the way out toward the coast. So I think there's a few parts that are like landlocked watersheds, where the water flows into an area and then kind of pools up and makes a large lake there. And I know like there's the Klamath Lake, and then that runs out to the Klamath River. So that ends up getting out to the ocean. But I don't know if like places like Goose Lake or just like these inland lake areas, I think they're just fed by the body of water. And I don't really know if a lot of that would actually get back out into the water cycle to head back out toward the ocean and then, you know, come back up or something. So it's kind of interesting thinking about just some of the old watershed stuff that used to be out there, how populations used to try and work around all that. You know, like you go out to a place like Fort Rocky and you read some of the signs and you look at how back in the Pleistocene area, that whole region out there was part of, what's called a Pluvian Lake. It's like a prehistoric Pleistocene era lake that really took up a huge amount of land out in Central Oregon. Really what we think of now is just a large desert area covered with sagebrush with really very few land features, was actually just all underwater. The land feature of Fort Rock that we've visualized now, I think came about geologically during the Pleistocene era before the Ice Age and probably a while back before that. But during that time, it was underwater. It was under a lake bed. And so that's where you get that formation, is it was underwater and then it kind of eroded around it, this aquifer and lava. Or aquifer and magma, I don't know. It met at a certain time and made this big ring, this big Fort Rock style formation, and that's still what's out there now. But it's really amazing when you get out there and you go see it, and then you kind of start to reckon with the perspective that this all was once underwater. This was like an inland sea. And then after the Ice Age, or before the Ice Age, there's some evidence of kind of, well, I don't know. Who knows? But there's evidence to show that the Clovis people, the Clovis tribes, which I think were the ones that at least in modern archaeology have been identified as the group that was first to come over the land bridge, first to come into the Northwest and populate parts of the West Coast and into the South and onward and such. But I guess these Clovis people had like a specific type of way of building their tools, their stone tools that they would use. And that's a bit of a way that you can track some things, is if you do find an archaeological artifact, you can kind of identify by the technique used to build the stone tool. Like there's different measures. I think one of the oldest ones that's looked for is fluting. And that was a technique used by the Clovis people where they would sort of make an arrowhead or a spear point, really spear points. I don't know if they had flying bows and arrows at that time, that far back, but they'd build these spear points and they would flute the end, the bottom of it. So like if you were to imagine, it would be kind of this concaved slope that was sort of Dremeled out of the bottom base of the rock so that you could kind of fit that down in the center of a stick, really, and then wind that up. So you kind of make both ends kind of taper off to a point, and then you would jam one end into the stick and then wrap it, and then I don't know, you know, put sap on it or you know, whatever you could do to fasten it down. But I guess that was one of the techniques that was used early on, and that's one of the things that they look for when they're trying to find really old populations in Oregon. Sometimes it's fluting. That doesn't always mean that it's really old, though, I suppose. But I guess there's like handfuls of different technical or technological generations of stone tool building out there. And you can kind of tell a little bit. But it's very fascinating stuff. And man, was it not amazing to get out there and to really recognize that, you know, I was around a natural human man-made, well, a semi-natural but man-made artifact of a home or of an establishment that's as old, I don't know how old it is. Maybe it's as old as early Rome, late Rome. Who would know how old it is in comparison to Europe? I'm not really sure. Maybe it goes back even further than that. It seems like there was population in that area of Oregon for thousands of years. I think, was it the Paiute that was out there? Could be different, but I know the Paiute were south of that area. The Paiute were in Lake County, I think, like through Heart Mountain, Alvor, Nevada, the Malheur area. All of that was Paiute. So maybe this was still in the Paiute section. But I know that really, you know, like what we've noticed in the last few hundred years, if you were to look at the changes of a map, even within the United States over the last, say, take 600 years, not even 7,000 years. Take the last 600 years of the United States of America and then look at all the different maps that would be the territorial ranges of those people who ended up being in power during that time. It's really interesting to see and to kind of take note to how something that seems permanent or seems to have the nature of permanence in it when you speak about it, like that was the range of the Paiute Indian. Well, was it for 600 years or for that long? Did it move around? Did they have, I don't know, territorial engagements? Was there really that many of them? Were they there all the time? I don't know any of that information. So it's kind of interesting when you sort of think about it, but it could have been any number of large groups of people that probably would have no idea they were called the Paiute Indian. But all really very interesting stuff. And man, was it so cool to get out there and see a real a teepee ring. It's really fun. It's one of the cooler pieces of archaeological artifacts that I've run into. I mean, you know, you see petroglyphs, you see a lot of things, but really, you know, you were sitting in the home of someone that lived thousands of years ago. That lived out in the same place that I do now. You know, really fascinating stuff. But I had a blast going out there and getting to check it out. And it was really, I kind of love this stuff with the story, with the background to it, where you kind of get to attach something that you recognize with it, with what you get to talk about or what you get to show with it. So I thought it was a really cool story. It was really fun to get out there and go see it. I remembered it from years ago. I think I'd seen it about 10 or 11, 12 years ago. And I think I had tried to go back to it, but I didn't really see how to or where it was, and I wasn't really sure. It's not something on the map.
You can check out more information at billynewmanphoto.com. You can go to billynewmanphoto.com/support if you want to help me out and participate in the value for value model that we're running this podcast with. If you receive some value out of some of the stuff that I was talking about, you're welcome to help me out and send some value my way through the portal at billynewmanphoto.com/support. You can also find more information there about Patreon and the way that I use it. If you're interested or feel more comfortable using Patreon, that's patreon.com/billynewmanphoto. So I wanted to talk about the training stuff that I've been doing. I think I had mentioned I had done a good bit of work with other programs in the past, but this is really the first time that I've gotten into spending time learning specifically about some of the features and the controls in Logic Pro and now Logic Pro 10.5. So what I had done is gone to now what's called LinkedIn Learning. LinkedInLearning.com, huh? There used to be a website called lynda.com, and lynda.com was these screencast video tutorials of how to use different types of software and how to be trained, you know, just training for different types of most of the time computer related skills.
So I've used that service for a number of things over the years. Specifically, I think Chris Orwig's Lightroom tutorial is probably like a standard for a lot of photographers that have been interested in learning about photography editing. And so all of those courses that have existed over the years have a lot of good information in them. But I went back to what would be lynda.com now, as it has been purchased by LinkedIn through Microsoft. It's now called LinkedIn Learning. Right on, huh? So LinkedIn Learning has all of the old Lynda videos, including all the updates to the videos that they're still continuing to produce. So I went on and I tried to find some training videos about Logic Pro 10. There's a number of videos for like essential training for Logic Pro 10, but there's nothing, because now this new update, Logic Pro 10.5, is really only maybe 2 weeks old or something. There's just no new video training established for it. So I think for Logic Pro 10.4, there's a full essential training video that was produced by, Scott Hirsch, a music producer out of New York. And he just kind of goes through the controls and the system and stuff. And you get a good feel of how to make changes, how to use different features, how to use the mixer versus like the linear tracking system, you know, how to use different controls and stuff. A lot of the stuff is similar if you've used GarageBand, like I was mentioning, or another digital audio workstation that does multi-tracking in the past. But it was cool, yeah, learning like some techniques about how to apply different compress, or how to make the settings of a compressor do more specifically the types of things that I'm wanting to do in a mix. I think was some good information for me to be learning about through the Logic Pro training stuff. Also, in addition to that, so LinkedIn Learning is a paid service. You can get a 1 month free trial of that too, which I'm taking advantage of at this moment to get some new information in. But what you can do is go to YouTube and look up similar training videos. And there's a lot of people, a lot of music producers out there that have done their own screencasts of kind of walking through different services or different techniques that these digital audio workstations provide. So I was looking at a guy's website. I think it was whylogicprorules.com, and that had a lot of good training videos on it too. He had a lot of information about how different pieces of it work and just how to make use of a lot of the techniques that you'd have to apply in a certain piece of the software to make it more effective. And I thought that was really cool. I really appreciated some of the stuff that he'd done. And
thanks a lot for checking out this episode of the Billy Newman Photo Podcast.
Hope you guys check out some stuff on billynewmanphoto.com. A few new things up there, some stuff on the homepage, some good links to other outbound sources, some links to books, some links to some podcasts, links to some blog posts. All pretty cool. But yeah, check it out at billynewmanphoto.com. Thanks a lot for listening to this episode of the podcast. Talk to you next time.